Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Ari Shavit, senior correspondent with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and author of My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. The topic of today's talk will be Israel and American Jewry, Two Miracles Now Challenged. This is part one of a two-part lecture given by Mr. Shavit. The second half will be broadcast next Monday, September 28th at 12 noon, presented as the 2015 Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture. This program, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, April 22nd, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is retired Omaha surgeon and co-sponsor of the program, Eugene Speedy Zweibach.
Our guest has been an Israeli paratrooper, a student of philosophy, a civil rights activist, and a leading journalist for Haaretz, as Rabbi mentioned, since 1995. Recent events that have occurred in the Middle East in the last few months make this visit seem almost eerily prophetic and important. Debbie and I are pleased to join UNO, Tom and Darlin Feldman, the ADL, in hosting Ari Shavit, who will discuss Israel and American Jewry, Two Miracles Now Challenged.
Thank you so much. It's a real privilege for me to be here. It was not that easy to leave my family for our Independence Day. My wife has some question marks about the fact that I'm not with them right now during Yom HaTzmaut. But I generally, as you'll hear throughout my talk in the coming minutes, am deeply committed to the relationship between our two great communities. And this is why I think it's so important for me to be here and for all of us to be engaged in a truthful, hopefully deep conversation about Israel, about American Jewry, about our relationship and about our challenges. But beyond that, there is a kind of emotional thing, because for me, I was never in Nebraska before. So, of course, these days, your town is, for the world, in many ways, Buffettville. But for me, you know, for me, I think the first time I realized there is a Nebraska in the world, I was a very political child. And there were very important primaries held here in 1968, in which my hero, Robert Kennedy, won, sadly 2 months before he was murdered. So ever since, I had this kind of thing about that state that seems to be at the very center of America. But I can tell you that from the moment that my plan descended, and every minute that I had here throughout the day, I'm in love with your town. It seems so peaceful, so civilized. There's something so good here. So I'm very happy to be here with you. And the fact that there is such a wonderful, not extremely large, but such a thriving, committed, warm Jewish community is for me something deeply meaningful. And I'm really, really happy to be spending Yom HaTzmaut with you people here. I asked to talk not only about the problems, which I will talk a lot about soon, but to put it in the grand context. And the grand context in that of really the miracles. The rabbi just mentioned the 23,000 young Israelis who died throughout the years in the wars, which is such a horrible price to pay for our independence and to maintain our sovereignty over the years. But let us remember that in Babi Yar, in one day, more people, more Jews were murdered. So if anyone does not understand why there is a need for Israel and why Israel is so remarkable in so many ways, it's just that. One day in Babi Yar, one day in Auschwitz, worse than all the agony and all the pain throughout these 67 years. So on the one hand, we have the tragedy of the conflict, and it doesn't let go. But on the other hand, on this day especially, we must see the larger picture. And this is where I will begin. The 20th century was the most dramatic century in our dramatic history. Its first half was our worst ever. We lost every third Jew. Think of us assembled here. Every third Jew. But the second half of the 20th century was by far our best ever. We created the man-made miracle of Jewish sovereignty there, and you created the man-made miracle of the perfect diaspora here. So let us talk about both, see what they are, and talk about the challenges facing them. First, our miracle. Why is Israel such a miracle? First of all, because no other people did what we did. Look around the globe. No other people rebuilt its national home after 2,000 years. We tend to take it for granted, but this is an astonishing phenomenon. But it's not only that, because the second element of the miracle has to do with the tragedy. When we came back to our ancient homeland to build our national home, we ended up living under a volcano. If anyone did not understand it until recent years, I think we all understand it today. Just read the paper every day. How much is there about this part of the world that is so dangerous? So we managed to build that home, to survive and thrive under the volcano. But then there is a third element. The third element of the Israeli miracle is that Israel is a democracy. With all its problems, with all its flaws, it's a vivid, energetic, sometimes too loud democracy. Why is that wondrous? Because they had no reason to be a democracy. 95% of the people who came to Israel came from countries that had no democratic tradition whatsoever. In Russia, in East Europe, in North Africa, in the Arab world. I am kind of the exception because of my English background. 95% of the Jews who came to Israel did not live in a real democracy before they came there. But that's not the only thing. We ended up in a region, in an environment, that totally rejects democracy. And it's not only that, because we ended up in a 100-year war. So because of the lack of democratic traditions, because of the lack of a democratic environment, and because of the ongoing conflict, we had every reason to become a fascist country. And yet we are so different, Sometimes we are like too free. Our life is on the bordering on anarchy. Israel, again, with all the problems, and you'll hear about the problems and my criticism, with all the problems, Israel is an unbelievable oasis of liberty in the Middle East. How did we do this? How did the miracle come to be? First of all, it was the brilliant diagnosis. When I looked into the history of my own family, which is the history of my nation, when I looked at my great-grandfather, Herbert Bentwich, who traveled from London to Jaffa in 1897, I asked myself, why would such a Victorian gentleman, who had it all, why would they leave behind London, that was the capital of the world, and travel to the remote, desolate province Palestine was? Chaim Weizmann, our great leader, used to say, you don't have to be crazy to be a Zionist, but it helps. And my great-grandfather's journey seemed to be crazy. But it was not. Because the early Zionists, of which he was a junior leader, partner, they had two brilliant insights. One truly tragic, and the other just sad. The first one was that Europe was becoming a death trap to its Jews. They did not know there will be a Holocaust. They couldn't have imagined that the 20th century would produce such places as Auschwitz and Treblinka, gas chambers, trains. But they knew that there is no hope for us in Europe. For 1,500 years, we were Europe's ultimate other. We were treated like dirt. Something important to say these days when the Europeans say such things about us. This is the real context. But the early Zionists realized it's going to get worse, that the new race-based anti-Semitism is becoming more dangerous than the old religion-based anti-Semitism. And faced with the most radical challenge a people can be faced with, the challenge of extinction, they came up with the most radical solution one can think of. And they transferred us from one continent to another and took a land and built a nation and revived a language just so we will have life. That was the first element of the diagnosis. The second has to do with our life today. Because they realized that once anti-Semitism will be less brutal and the pogroms will subside, we, non-ultra-Orthodox Jews, will be challenged in a modern era. We, emancipated, modern Jews, who do not live in ghettos, we will have a challenge maintaining our civilization and our people. Ultra-Orthodox Jews will be okay in their enclaves, in Brooklyn or Antwerp or Manchester or Bnei Brak. They'll be there in 100 years' time and probably in 1,000 years' time. But we, non-Orthodox Jews, we have a problem. And in order to deal with that, we need a place that is a powerhouse for a modern, relevant Jewish identity. This is why Israel was needed, is needed, and will be needed. It's a different question, and I'll talk about it, whether Israel is true to this mission, whether Israel is a source of inspiration to young Jews of the diaspora. And we'll get to that later. But that was the brilliant diagnosis, that if we do not change ourselves in a dramatic way, at a horrible price, we'll be endangered physically first and endangered spiritually later on. But after the diagnosis came the second layer, statesmanship. Again, think of where we were. We had no sovereignty, no kingdom, no republic. We didn't have political entity for 2,000 years. And yet, in the first generations of the revival of the Jewish people as a political body, we had amazing, amazing political genius. Herzl, Weizmann, Ben-Gurion. But not only them. There was a kind of political elite surrounding them. So a people that came from nowhere politically, that just stepped on the stage of history for the first time, was so brilliant and sophisticated in the first generations. Something that makes me somewhat sad when I look at our leadership these days. The third element of the Israeli that made the Israeli miracle possible was Israeli exceptionalism. There's much talk in this country about American exceptionalism, but believe me, there is Israeli exceptionalism. Because these great leaders and that elite and the people who created the country realized that we are doing something unique and that the Israeli condition, for better and for worse, with the triumph and the tragedy, is a unique condition. And therefore, although they were very worldly and very aware of things that were happening everywhere around the globe, they knew we must create unique solutions to our unique condition. So we did not invent one wheel there. We invented 12 wheels. The kibbutz and the moshav and the istadut and kupat cholim, you name it. Today we talk about technological innovation in Israel. What's so amazing was the political and social innovation of the Zionist community and young Israel in their first 50, 60 years. Without that, we would not have survived. The fourth element that made the Israeli miracle possible is a kind of balance. As I said, Zionism was the most amazing revolution. It's probably the most successful of the 20th century revolutions. But the reason it succeeded where other revolutions failed is that it had a kind of inner balance. On the one hand, there was the zeal, there was this commitment, the idealism, the harshness of revolutionaries, people who were willing to do the impossible. In my book, I write about Enharod, about the kibbutz, the pioneers, but there were many manifestations of that side of our life. But we always maintained the balance, because on the other side, while you had this kibbutz heroism, you had Tel Aviv. You had the party, you had the smile, you had the sense of humor. We were not into a kind of serious, somber revolutionary spirit. We had the two elements. It was a revolution on the one hand, but there was a twinkle in the eye on the other hand, which made this success possible. In my mind, these elements come to a kind of climax and what I see as the climax of the Israeli miracle. People ask me, what have I learned during the years I wrote the book? What amazed me more than all was Israel of the 1950s. Pioneers, you had pioneers here as well. Warriors, you and others had warriors as well. I am especially close to ours, but it happened elsewhere. The civilian heroism of Israel of the 1950s cannot be matched by any other nation. Imagine America, God forbid, going through a war in which it loses 3.5 million people. God forbid. And then imagine America in the following 3.5 years absorbing 500 million immigrants. Is it humanly possible? Can it be done? Israel did that. Israel of the 1950s, especially of the early 1950s, is such a triumph of the human spirit. You don't have to be Jewish or Israeli or pro-Israeli to see that. Any decent person looking at that phenomenon with clear eyes is amazed at what was done there. And in my mind, that was the reflection of all that I've talked about. The diagnosis, the statesmanship, the exceptionalism, and this kind of balance. All that made that amazing achievement possible. Because it's not only the numbers. Who are the people who went there? So many of them were refugees from the Arab world who lost everything overnight. We talk a lot about Palestinian refugees, and we should. There were nearly a million Jewish Arab refugees from the Arab countries. But then there were Holocaust survivors, people with numbers tattooed into their arms, people who had nightmares at night, people who just lost their first family 2 years before and now created a new family, sometimes not telling their new kids that they had other kids 7, 8 years before. These people had every reason to become human wrecks. But their revenge was not suicide bombing. Their revenge was to live. And their revenge was to send their kids to the best schools and to build a health system that is better than yours. So Israel of the 1950s, in my mind, is a source of deep inspiration. And it really the climax of that achievement. Sadly, politically, we've lost our way since. We don't have the same kind of leadership and the same kind of discipline that combines vision and dreams with realism and morality in that old way. But I still think that you have in the Israeli spirit of the day the continuation of elements of that ethos. You saw it even in the last summer with Iron Dome on the one hand being such a remarkable system that uses technology in order to defend a free society, and on the other hand, in the kind of resilience and cohesion of Israeli society at times of crisis, not a time of peace. And tomorrow I will talk about the internal challenges facing Israel and about the challenges to that society. But there is that spirit among Israeli individuals and Israeli society while we don't see it in the Israeli political body. But now let's talk about your miracle. Look at yourself. Think of your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. Where were they and where are you? Look at this astounding establishment we sit in. Look at Jewish life all around. We never had it so good. Never. So there is one side of this that there is much talk about. The personal success of Jews in this country is mind-boggling. Business, arts, professional life, academic life, wherever you go. The Nobel Prizes, the billionaires, the lawyers, the doctors, the artists, the writers, the comedians, everything. I go around campuses, it's still striking. You go to Ivy League universities, the rate of Jews is just mind-boggling, uncomprehensible. But that's the known story. It's an astonishing story and an unexplained story, but that's the known story. What people do not talk about is the great collective success of you people. Because it's not only the personal success of personal individual Jews. It's what you've created here. You created this universe that I think some of you take for granted. Congregations and federations and organizations and foundations. Sometimes some of us are ashamed about Jewish power, Jewish success. I don't think we should be ashamed of it. We should be proud of it. This should be an example to any other minority in this country or other countries. You did not rob anyone. You came from nothing. And within 100 years, there's longer history, but the great success of the last 100, 120 years is a source of amazing, amazing inspiration. Because while we did nation building in Israel, you did community building. So how did you do it? With this spirit of keeping solidarity within a free society, of being committed, the rate of Jewish philanthropy is unbelievable. You have this system of voluntary taxation that you invented, that even for us Israelis is almost not to be understood. We did what we did with the state, with laws, with government, with an army, with police. But you did it without anyone forcing it to you to do. Just because you as individuals lived within communities that maintained this. And when I go around the country in the last year, I can tell you I'm just overwhelmed by this. And the reason I'm so happy to be in Omaha, Nebraska on my Independence Day is just that. Because to come here to the middle of the middle of the middle of America and to see your community here, perhaps you are not aware of it, but you are a miracle yourselves. And yet, we have to be sincere and candid and to see that both challenges, both miracles, are seriously, seriously challenged. Tomorrow I will talk about Israel's internal challenges. Today I'll just mention the external ones. In many ways, the last seven, it's not the last, the, from 2006, seven to 2014, to last summer, we lived in a kind of bubble in Israel. Because of our security success, our Air Force, our Shabak, our Iron Domes, because of our startup nation, our high-tech boom, we began believing that we are disconnected from the Middle East. Sometimes I felt that we Israelis feel that in some ingenious way we managed to physically disconnect Israel from the Middle East, as if a series of explosions has happened along the Jordan Valley, and we are now not connected to Jordan anymore. We are drifting in the Mediterranean. We just passed Corsica. We are on our way to Ibiza. But then came the summer, and the sirens were howling, and suddenly this Middle East was here, in the middle of Tel Aviv. We were not able to run away from it and to escape. In my mind, that was one huge wake-up call, to see what is around us. And what are the challenges we face? Because, in my mind, the sirens are still howling. We don't hear them, but they are howling. The first one is Iran. I've been a proud Iran alarmist for 12 years. I was never an Iranian hawk. I never supported bombing. But since 2002, 2003, I realized this was the issue. And many of my friends and family members ridiculed me. Why do I care so much about those centrifuges, distant centrifuges in Iran? I think now we realize that this is the big issue. Let me say the following. My prime minister, whom I'm not a fan of, I think his diagnosis off the Iran threat is pretty much accurate. A bit over-dramatized, but pretty much accurate. But the great mistake of my prime minister is to make Iran an Israel issue. Iran is no Israel issue. Iran is a challenge to our civilization. If Iran would go nuclear, Saudi Arabia would go nuclear, Gulf states would go nuclear, Egypt would go nuclear, Turkey will go nuclear, and Israel will have to change its very responsible nuclear policy. The outcome will be something we never tried in the past, a multipolar nuclear system in the world's most dangerous region. If this is not strategic hell, I do not know what is strategic hell. So, if that would happen, that will have implication not only in the Middle East. Definitely Tel Aviv. I don't expect apocalypse. I don't think a bomb will be thrown in Tel Aviv soon. But just having that kind of reality will change life in Tel Aviv. But later on, it will change life in Europe, and later on it will change life in America. Because you have your strategic Air Force base here with all that it goes with. The great success of the international community in the last 70 years was to maintain what I call the post-Nagasaki miracle. The fact that we had the genie was out of the bottle, but we controlled it. If Iran will go nuclear, the chances of having nuclear terror and nuclear horror throughout the 21st century will increase dramatically. The fear of a nuclear Armageddon will not come back. But the chances of having nuclear 9/11s will increase dramatically. So Iran is a big deal. Whether the deal is good or not, Iran is a big deal. And sadly, we've not addressed it in time. We've failed in stopping it when it was easy to stop it. And right now we face a difficult, difficult dilemma. Because they nearly achieved a technological victory, and we have to see that they do not have a political victory on top of that. The second challenge facing Israel is the Arab chaos. So many of us, most of us, almost all of us, were so naive over 4 years ago. We really believed the Google kids will rule Egypt. Many of my distinguished friends in the American media compared the Arab Spring to the American Revolution. Well, well. Only a few years have passed, and only in Tunisia there is some hope. I'm an Israeli, but I care about my Arab neighbors. And when I look at Arab young men and women, I ask myself, what hope do they have? The political options facing them are an Islamic theocracy, a military dictatorship, a reactionary monarchy, or bloody chaos. These are the options. So it's so troubling to live within that environment. So from a narrow, first of all, we have a terrible human catastrophe all around us, mainly in Syria, where 220,000 people were murdered, and the world cannot do anything about it. But it ain't that pretty in Iraq or Libya or Yemen these days. So to live in that, even if it's convenient to some Israeli strategists because some of the old threats are gone. There is no Syrian army that will invade the Golan Heights. But to live within this chaotic situation is a troubling situation. The third challenge facing us is the Palestinian issue. In my mind, the present situation, the status quo, is endangering Israel's future, Israel's identity, and Israel's soul. If we go on with this present situation, we are endangering the Jewish democratic state. The present situation is a kind of a silent killer that is endangering us demographically, politically, and morally. But on the other hand, while we must act to change it, we have to remember the past. And the past is that we tried peace in 1993, we brought Yasser Arafat back to the land in April, May, 1994. 5 months later, the first bus exploded in Dizengoff Street in Tel Aviv. But we didn't give up. So in 2000, Ehud Barak goes to Bill Clinton's peace summit and breaks every Israeli taboo, agrees to a Palestinian state dividing Jerusalem, 100% of Gaza, 95% of the West Bank. Bill Clinton is the most qualified individual on this planet to bring peace. He has the EQ, IQ, and passion and compassion. But what is the outcome? The worst terror offensive a democracy experienced since World War II, with over 1,000 Israelis getting killed and then 3,000 Palestinians getting killed because we had two defenders. But we didn't give up. So comes Arik Sharon, perceived as a warmonger, the dangerous general, and he pulls out of Gaza, dismantles every settlement. No more checkpoints, no more settlements, no occupying Israeli army. Is the result a Palestinian Singapore? The outcome is a Hamas-controlled territory that fires rockets at Israel, and we saw how dangerous it was this summer. So we are in a bind. We must do something. We must change. We must move forward. But all previous attempts to bring about peace in the old way have failed. The fourth external challenge facing us is our relationship with the West. The great success of Zionism was because we always maintained two principles. We always had a deep alliance with the superpower, first the British, then the French, then you, the great alliance with America. But we also always understood we must capture the moral high ground. We are a small, lonely people. Many people don't like us. We are not China, we cannot do Tibet. We are not Russia, we cannot do the Ukraine. Ben-Gurion was as tough as nails when it came to war. But he always knew that before that, we must try peace and be willing to sacrifice a lot for peace. And because we had that, because we were accepted the partition plan in 37, we won in the 30s, because we accepted it in 47, we won in 48, and because of that failed peace summit in 2000, we survived the Second Intifada. But sadly, in recent years, we lost that old wisdom. And our relationship with the West is being eroded, not only because of us. There are troubling phenomena of anti-Semitism and political correctness that cause a kind of hostility to Israel that is totally unjustified. But we made our mistakes contributing to this dangerous process. So these are our challenges. But what is yours? As I told you, I spent a lot of time in North America, in Jewish North America in the last year. And I'm amazed by what I see. But I also see the great challenge facing your community. And that great challenge is the generation gap. By and large, people over 70 have the Holocaust as a context, and they are religiously committed to Israel and Jewish life. By and large, people over 50 have a strong Jewish identity, and they remember pre-67 Israel, and they whine and grind, but they cannot help it. They are there. People under 30 are in a different world. So many of them are confused about it. So many of them are torn. On the one hand, they have love, they have commitment. What they got from their parents, from their rabbis, from their communities, from a wonderful birthright experience they had. But on the other hand, they have difficulty with the way Israel is and with the way Israel is perceived. And when I go around campuses, I have heartbreaking conversations with so many youngsters. Rather than lecture and preach, I try to listen. And what I hear everywhere, is this torment of so many young people who want to love Israel but feel they are it's more and more difficult for them. There is the BDS issue, but what is worse than BDS is this tension of so many young Americans who are progressives, who feel there is a tension between their progressive identity and their commitment to Israel and to Jewish life. This is as dramatic as any of the other challenges that I've talked about. Because it's risking your future and risking our future. And if we do not do something about it, we'll be in real, real trouble. As I see it, we have a decade, because we still have the resources, the talent, the goodwill, the energy. We've not lost the young generation yet. But if we will not change our ways, both in Israel and here, we will not have a new kind of message. We are endangering ourselves in this country. So with all that, am I a pessimist? I'm not. I really believe in Israelis, and I really believe in Jews. But in order to deal with all these challenges, we need new ideas, we need new vision, and we need a new spirit. So regarding Iran, I think we must endorse an assertive diplomatic approach. We can go into details later. But there is no other way but the assertive diplomatic way. If a deal is to be struck, it has to be struck when you know it's a deal with the mafia. Sometimes there is no other way but to strike a deal with the gangsters. But the only way that deal can work is if you are aware of the fact that there are gangsters, and this is how you construct the deal. If you elude themselves that there are some pleasant nuns, you're in for a surprise. Regarding the Arab chaos and the Palestinian issue, we need a new peace concept. We need a new approach that will bring about a realistic peace that addresses reality as it is. If we cannot have a two-state solution tomorrow, let's launch two-state dynamics that will lead to a two-state state that eventually, when we are all mature, will bring about the two-state solution. And let us work with those Arab moderates in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Jordan, in the Gulf, who are now closer to us because they are so worried about Iran and ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Brotherhood. Regarding the West and regarding the internal issue, we must have a new kind of energetic, inspiring liberal Zionism. We must put ourselves again on the right side of history and on the right side of progress. Essentially, we are a David, but we must prove to ourselves and must prove to others in our actions, in our rhetorics, that we are a David. When I go on campuses, I tell people, Israel and the Jews are an underdog on steroids. Fundamentally, we are weak. Fundamentally, we are endangered. We are an endangered species. But looking at that weakness with wisdom and vision, we created force. We created power in different ways, there and here. So let's see it as it is. But again, go back to a kind of moral dimension while remembering and learning again how to love ourselves. Let me end this on a personal note. We are all boat people. In the past of every person sitting here, there was a boat. There was a moment that there was an avalanche, and we had to run for our lives. And we ran for our lives to save ourselves. We got on a boat. So one boat went to the Promised Land. The other boat came to the Golden Land. And throughout the years, there was a kind of sibling rivalry between the two. Who got on the right boat? There were years that it seemed that we got on the right boat and you on the wrong boat. And there were years that it seemed that you got on the right boat and we on the wrong. But now we know, that we all got on the right boat. There is no future for us without you, and there is no future for you without us. So we have to go back to understand this fundamental truth. In my book, I ask myself three questions. Why Israel? What's Israel? And will Israel? Why Israel? Because there is a need, an imperative, a moral imperative, to have a home for the homeless people. And what's Israel? Its vitality against all odds. And will Israel? And will this great American Jewish community? That depends on us. Thank you very much.
I love this. I ask Ari how much time for questions. As much as you want. So we have 4 more hours for questions. Please.
You spoke about beautifully, and you spoke about as far as college campuses and our youngsters. I was curious. We know that the problem exists. I was curious as to solutions that you've seen or your ideas for how to work with our youngsters and those on college campuses, that under 35 crowd, so that they don't become disengaged from Israel.
So I'm obsessed with this. So I give this a lot of thought. So I hope actually to give you a more serious answer within months or such time to really come up with a comprehensive document or really like a kind of real vision. But I'll give you an example of where I think we should be headed. I think that one of the terrible things that has happened in this country, although in many ways it's the fault of my government, is that we've not allowed young people to ask questions and to have open discussion. We created the overprotective approach to Israel became very dangerous and very destructive because we didn't give young people a relevant narrative. We made Israel a kind of marble statue, and they were expected just to say it's all shiny and wonderful. You cannot really love a marble statue. And young people have an amazing sense, definitely this day and age, for anything that's fake, that's a cliche. Ironically, with our love, we turned Israel into a cliche. And then they are so exposed to the venom of the hostile people on the other side. Because we never gave them a real context. We never dealt with occupation in a serious way. We never gave them a complex understanding of it. So when suddenly they are aware of it, they're learning about it, they are so disillusioned, they are shocked, and they are exposed to really ridiculous, sometimes, anti-Israel propaganda because they are in a kind of rebellious mood. So many young people told me, you know, we never heard there is a problem. And then when they do hear about the problem, it's they hear the wrong, you know, it's, I don't want to talk about it perhaps in the sanctuary, but it's a bit not giving, you know, sexual education. So they get it in the wrong way because you ignored this, the fact that there are some such needs and there is such an aspect to life. So they just, when they get it in a vulgar, aggressive way. So one thing is to have the new kind of conversation. And this is what I'm trying to promote. This is in many ways what I'm about now. I love Israel so much, and I'm so committed to Jewish life. I also have this weakness, something is wrong with me, I love Jews, actually. But that I'm not afraid of the problems, of the flaws, even of the sins. I mean, this is human. And I ask people, again, to go back, to open up this new kind of approach, you know, to let, you know, the greatest compliment I heard from really hundreds of youngsters, they come to me and say to me, you know, for the first time you made me love Israel again. Because I'm candid, because I address the problems, because I don't come with some... First of all, I'm open to everything. Everything can be said. Everything can be asked. I'm not into any sort of censorship. The people who are doing censorship, and I understand their concerns. You know, as I said, we are a minority. There are people who don't like us. I understand why people are overprotective. But it's counterproductive. It's counterproductive. So first of all, this kind of new discourse. The second element has to be, I said, there are two things that have to happen. One, I think, is to allow people who are concerned about Israel to participate in a kind of fixing Israel process. I care about Israel, I want to fix Israel. And in this sense, I'm open to everybody. Let each one choose the Israel side that he likes, that he cares about, and promote whatever his vision is, right, left, and center. I think that if you allow people, say, to go and do work, if there are people who are critical of Israel because they are concerned about human rights, let them come do human rights work in Israel. Let them do, people who care about the environment, let them do environmental work. Gay rights, women's rights, minority rights, whatever. Let people be engaged not only through the traditional Zionist kind of establishment way, but let them be involved with anything that, you know, tikkun olam, tikkun Israel. You know, if you don't like it, fix it. And the third element, I think, has to be doing things that really combine tikkun olam and tikkun Israel values. I mean, let us do tikkun olam work as Jews. And let us do it in a combination between, in alliance, cooperation between Israel and between young American Jews. So my yearning is to have a kind of Jewish Peace Corps. If we will do, we'll combine Israel's ability with our Air Force and our Medical Corps and all that. We are so good when times in crisis in all kinds of third world countries. But we don't put it in a political and moral context. We don't know how to articulate it, even when we do the right thing. We do so many things right and we never know how to express it. So if we'll combine these abilities with the yearning of so many young American Jews to do work in the third world or different, and if we'll have a kind of voluntary body that allows people either to work with Jews in Israel or with non-Jews in Israel or in the third world, but to do it under the Jewish flag, so to speak, with a kind of Israeli diaspora cooperation, I think that that kind of project can really inspire many people, and suddenly Israel will not be associated just with occupation and ultra-Orthodox segregation of women, but it will be associated with values that these young people can relate to. I think that these are like early thoughts about where we should be headed.
A totally different question. In Israel, 80% of the Israelis are secular, as we know. And in the United States, most of the Jews are Reform. Yet in Israel, the Haredim are holding the most prominent place. Or actually, what I want to ask you is, do you see any problem in this situation of Haredim in Israel holding, and the Jews in America are mostly Reform?
Thank you, Rabbi, for asking rabbinic questions.
So, first of all, obviously, there is a problem. You know, I was married twice. And my first marriage was conducted by not a reform, but a conservative rabbi in Jerusalem. By the way, a rather prominent American conservative rabbi, the late Arthur Herzberg. And it was a perfectly, you know, kosher Jewish wedding, but it was not recognized by the state because he was a conservative rabbi and not... And then a year later, we got married in some remote British resort town, and the state of Israel has more respect for the two clerics in Bridport, Dorset, than to a rabbi, a prominent American rabbi. So this is crazy, obviously, and it's unacceptable. And we know the answer. Why is that the case? As you said, it's not because that most Israelis are there. It's because we have a weird political system, even more weird than yours. And it gives the ultra-Orthodox political power that... So on the one hand, it's unacceptable and we should change it. On the other hand, two things. First of all, I think the change has to be gradual. We cannot... You know, we have to understand Israel is not America. And again, sometimes Americans have a difficulty understanding Israel because America is different than much of the world as well. Because here, the separation of church and state is like nowhere else. You know, you have a unique model of yours, and ours is extreme on the other side. So we have to understand that Israel will not have that sort of thing. You will have a different kind of model. But there are many, many models around the world. You know, yours is not the only one. But we have to reform Israel in this sense, mainly for ourselves, but mainly because of what we're talking here. Because we have, and this is why... In the arguments I have in Israel with ultra-Orthodox and the extreme nationalists, I say, you people who are committed, who are supposed to be hyper-Jews and hyper-Zionists, you're risking the Jewish people and the entire project, because you are the ones that are driving away Jews throughout the world. So we have to reform, but we need to do it in a wise and gradual way. We cannot be overdone. That's one thing to remember. The other thing to remember is that although there are such terrible, absurd situations legally and politically, let's not taint Israel in this sense. You know, sometimes because of that, people think Israel is a theocracy. It's not. Life in Israel, in real life in Israel, is very free and very liberated. So we find our way, like I did by marrying in Dorset, around the system and around this, there is a real difference, if you use the French term, you know, between the pays royal and the pays real in Israel. The real life is much more closer to the American way than what you read in the papers about our crazy politics and the manifestations. But definitely, it's on us Israelis to change that situation in a gradual but determined manner.
Thank you very much, Ari.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ari Shavit, senior correspondent with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and author of My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. His topic was Israel and American Jewry, Two Miracles Now Challenged. This has been part one of a two-part lecture given by Mr. Shavit. The second half will be broadcast next Monday, September 28th at 12 noon, presented as the 2015 Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture. This program, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, April 22, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.